it makes sense that there would be a, was it a blue dragon in the mountains? What's the mountainous dragon?
Blue is desert.
It makes no sense that there would be a blue dragon. Live from the Mundangerous Missile Command in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 155 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about targeting player characters. But first, the Rogue Traders refuse to go quietly into that good night in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign. And later, the homing missile never misses a target in the Character Creation Forge. So we've got some news, Shane.
Yeah, a couple announcements, actually. You want to start with the biggest or the smallest?
Which is which?
good point. So the first announcement is we are finally, after 3 years independent, joining a podcast network.
I believe we are selling out.
Yep, we're giving in to the man.
Oh, so much money?
We've been bought out by Wizards of the Coast. It's just great.
That would be terrible. I actually wouldn't do that.
I have a price, so, to be clear.
It's remarkably low.
It is, yes. So we're joining Don't Split the Podcast Network, which is run by our friends James Intricasso and Rudy Basso.
If you haven't heard of them, it means you don't listen to this show, because James is heavily involved in two new Wizards of the Coast books that are coming out soon, Waterdeep Dragon Heist and Waterdeep Dungeons of the Mad Mage. Rudy is also the host of Half Spellbook Will Travel and Game O'Clock, two other podcasts on the Don't Split the Podcast Network. You may have also heard of a couple other shows on that network, like The Venture Maidens and Dames and Dragons, two pretty cool actual plays that I've been listening to sort of on the edge of my seat and biting my fingernails and also kind of yelling, because sometimes they make bad decisions, but sometimes they make great decisions.
Yeah, I would say that a non-zero factor in this decision was, I mean, obviously our friendship with James and Rudy, but also the fact that the only actual play podcast that you listen to happened to be on the network.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, that's true.
And that's a thing about your taste, shall we say.
Like, which is very good, by the way.
Your excessively high standards.
I tried very hard to listen to some other actual plays. I like some people, but I don't necessarily listen to those shows.
Also, Tabletop Babble, which is a great D&D discussion podcast. DM's Deep Dive with Mike Shea. The Newbie DM Minicast is another discussion program. So we're kind of joining a good lineup of discussion shows as well.
Yeah, I saw Lisa Chen started up Behold Her on DSPN. And when that happened, I was like, wait a minute. No, we're next in line. But, you know, we're slow and take our good sweet time.
Right.
With everything. So actually, we will be at the DSPN panel / meetup at Gen Con. That's Saturday at 5 p.m. at a thus far secret location, which will be revealed at some point, I guess, on social media. Is that how the kids communicate these days?
Yeah. So, and we'll announce it on the show as best we can. Given that we don't actually know the secret location, we're kind of along for the ride, too.
I mean, I hope it's in Indianapolis.
I hope it's in, yeah, and preferably in a bar.
Oh, well, then we're great.
Yeah.
All right. So, in other news, we actually have a new URL.
Yes. We have, after 3 years, finally acquired the rights to www.totalpartythrill.com.
It sounds weird to hear you say that.
It does. I'm so used to saying thrillcast.com. But yeah, so it turns out it's a very small world. We knew we didn't own, we couldn't own the domain when we started the show, so that's why we took cast.
Yeah, because we were like, I mean, how long is this going to last?
Right.
20 episodes?
Exactly. It turns out 3 years later, we were kind of like, oh, we should go ahead and, you know, acquire that. Did a whois search and small world. It turns out it is owned by a listener and now a friend of the show, Rob Hebert. Who has owned it since before we started, and sent him an email through like a, you know, whois lookup. He was really cool, gave us the domain for a remarkably reasonable price, one that we could afford, more importantly. And then the story kind of gets even more weird.
Even weirder?
Yeah, even smaller world. Let's put it that way. Turns out Rob is friends with Christopher Gray, who ran the Let's Kill Strahd adventure for us at PAX Unplugged.
Oh, you mean that awesome one where, like, we decimated Strahd in two rounds?
Yeah, the only highlight of PAX Unplugged
was,
for us.
It was the only thing we liked.
Right. So it just turns out that, like, you know, everybody involved here is good people. And we really appreciate that Rob was willing to offer us the name.
And I guess this is the smallest news. We were not nominated for Best Podcast at the Annies this year.
Nope. So you can just go ahead and ignore that category entirely.
Yeah, number of nominations, total party nil.
Yeah. We were good the first year. Apparently, we've just been dropping off.
But our listeners know that.
However, we do have some friends who have been nominated for some Ennies. Notably, Christopher Gray and Rob Hebert. You may remember them from the section we just talked about.
Yeah, they were nominated for The Happiest Apocalypse on Earth.
Twice, actually. Once for Best Interior Art and once for Product of the Year.
It's a horror satire set in a terrifying children's amusement park called Mouse Park. It's a Powered by the Apocalypse game where players work together to build the park and the attractions first, and then each character plays an employee at the park.
It's kind of a satire of, you know, childhood nostalgia and innocence, and then sort of the terror that's hidden just below the surface of youth.
It's basically Call of Cthulhu, but in Disney World.
Yeah, so basically it's like set in a Chuck E. Cheese.
I just read a Reddit thread asking for horror stories from people who used to work at Chuck E. Cheese. Basically, there's a lot of child bodily fluids
that's
involved.
Terrible. since they were nominated for both Best Product and Best Art, I guess I should talk a little bit about the art in the book. It's gorgeous. There's a lot of it and a lot of big art in the book as well. Multiple full-page art spreads. It's got some like kind of joyful and cartoonish elements, and then all of it is underlaid with this darker, more sinister, realistic elements. So it's kind of a cool stylistic match to what the game is about. And it reminded me a lot of Cause, amongst like modern, you know, street art.
We've got a link in the show notes, and voting is live right now at ennie-awards.com. That's ennie-awards.com. You'll need to do it quickly, though. The announcement was only made on July 4th, and voting ends Saturday, July 21st. That's this Saturday.
And there is a link directly to the voting in the show notes as well.
So, speaking of not winning any awards, Shane, where are we in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign?
I see what you did there with the pun.
Mm.
So, the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign is our Warhammer 40K Rogue Trader game played using Dark Heresy 2nd Edition rules by Fantasy Flight Games. And if you are a new listener to the podcast, perhaps through our recent DSPN announcement, I would recommend you go back to episode 76. That's where this campaign began, if you're interested in this little bit.
It seems so long ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, this is the second campaign we're recapping after Morning Glory, an Eberron campaign run with 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons, which started in what, like episode 4-ish?
Episode
1-ish?
0-ish?
Yeah. And the finale, I think, is in episode 73.
Right. But in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign, on the Dead World Malajap, the Rogue Traders and their two best companies of armsmen have been holed up in the Verza House, an ancient obsidian fortress once occupied by the fallen Dark Angel, Lord Cypher. And while your astropath Flair is fixated on an ominous book in a library deep within the house, Trank and Doc, the Archmilitant and Chief Medicae, are desperately trying to keep the defenses organized up above as you are under full-on assault by a force of mutant enemies, and they have breached the upper casements of the fortress and forced your troops to retreat and or fight for their lives.
Look, it's not our fault, okay? We were doing a great job until we were attacked.
Right. Turns out you are undermanned for defending a fortress of this size, and they were very determined attackers.
This place is thousands of years old, and the locks don't really work anymore.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Also, they have maps to the inside, and they're literally in the walls. Why couldn't we hold the line?
So Doc has been, steadfastly at work in the Medicaid, trying to get the wounded patched up, making sure he can save some lives, do his heretical experiments, those types of things. And he realizes that this isn't going to work. So he tasks a few of his corpsmen to handle the wounded, gathers up a platoon of the most able-bodied armsmen he can find, and proceeds back to the upper casements to meet up with Trank, where you guys are going to expunge the enemy.
Oh, yeah. Chamber by chamber, hallway by hallway, we lead a small squad back through doing what we're best at, which is killing. Which makes sense for the Archer Militant who, you know, has a pulse rifle. Makes maybe a little less sense for the Medicaid.
Yeah, the Medicaid has combat drugs.
So there's blood, there's guts, there's horror and carnage and violence, but little by little we're turning the tide. We're rescuing a few of our injured armsmen. Some of them are sort of shell-shocked. We basically patch them up as best we can and get them back in the fight. And the goal is to get people manning the rampart guns. We've got to remount those so that we can face them outward and start slamming large caliber las fire into the oncoming hordes outside of the Verza house.
And this is successful. You basically get the upper casements back under control. And the enemy seems to be receding. They've sort of lost the momentum of their charge and are falling back. But unfortunately, the defenders have scarcely a minute to breathe because your spotters call out a new threat, Ishan.
The assault on the casements is ebbing, which is good news, but it turns out that now there's a massive battering ram being positioned at the front gate.
And we'll find out what happens next week.
So this week, we're talking about targeting PCs. Shane, of course, this means targeting the people at your table with insults and barbs, learning their weaknesses, and hitting them where it hurts so that they cry and leave the game, yes?
No, it's about being an obnoxious Mac owner who undermines every PC user around them.
I mean, you're very Justin Long.
I am not.
I'm very John Hodgman.
I am recording this on a Mac right now.
You're such a poser.
Okay.
You could have built that same thing for half the price.
Dude, you're getting a Dell.
God. I prefer Gateway.
Well,
I love cow boxes.
I got some bad news for you.
I buy them used.
So in Austria, as we were driving down the street stuck at a red light, we passed like one of those electronic shops and they absolutely had an iMac, like the colorful iMac sitting
in
the window.
Wait, weren't those eMacs?
I don't know.
Or am I just super old?
It was the iMac. It was the one that has like the translucent plastic hood over like the back of it. It was like the all-in-one monitor and
looked like an
computer.
Egg. And had a handle at the top. You were 11 when those came out.
I didn't see it that closely.
I was 64.
Right. All right, but targeting PCs. So this comes as a listener question. It was part of a longer one, but we'll skip to the operative words here. As a GM, how do you judge whether to hit players where they're strong to reward their investment or where they are weak to punish their oversight? When should players feel like badasses for their specialization, and when should they feel threatened?
So the basic premise here is, you know, as a player, when you're building and playing a character, you usually end up making choices about them in a sort of rock, paper, scissors arrangement. You know, you can't be good at everything. So you're going to pick being good at pillar A, but that means that fundamentally you're going to be bad at either pillars B or C, maybe both.
Yeah, so if you're good at range combat, you're probably not good at close combat. If you're a master of fire, you're probably weak to water.
Right. Or, you know, maybe you're good at ranged and melee combat, but that probably means you're terrible at almost everything else.
Right. And this has kind of been built into the classic archetypes since D&D was founded, right? Like mage fighter, rogue cleric, you're one of the archetypes or a blend of them.
Yeah, it's kind of the reasoning behind having a party in the first place. You know, you can't have one character who's able to do everything on their own, because otherwise, why would they share the loot with anyone else?
Right. And this makes sense if you think about it from, like, you know, a game of rock, paper, scissors. Like, I throw rock, you throw paper, you win. The problem is that in an RPG, it's not really a random game. the GM knows what the party is going to throw before the encounter starts, because they can see, oh, you're a rock, and oh, you're a scissor, and oh, you're a paper. And the GM just chooses what they put out there in response.
Yeah, the GM knows literally all of the party's capabilities. They know if they've got a particular spell. They know if they have a particular damage type. They know if they're resistant to particular kinds of damage. They know if the rogue has a baseline 25 passive perception and will notice every single trap in the book.
Yeah, they also know if you're capable of stealth or capable of negotiation, right? Like, all of those things that go into your character sheet, the GM is aware of.
You also know your players.
Right.
And you may know that they really like to run headlong into danger, or they plan for 4 hours.
Or they often prefer to set things on fire and see what happens. This presents a problem, though, because if the GM knows the outcome, then choosing any challenge for the party is necessarily going to reflect to the party what the GM wanted.
Yeah, if you have a pyromancer in your party, is it fair of you to pick a fire elemental as an enemy? Well, that depends.
Right. One thing it depends on, I would say, is pacing. You know, a character only really feels like the character that you've built if they're getting to do their cool stuff. Like, whatever the game is, right? Like, if you're the demolitions expert and you go multiple sessions without getting to blow something up, are you really the demolitions expert?
Yeah, if you're the barbarian and you've been able to solve every interaction without actually getting into a fight, you know, maybe that's interesting. But it also means you're never raging, you're never hitting things, you're never using your damage bonus. You're never using your resistance. You're basically not a barbarian.
Right.
Or at least you're not getting to play one.
So I think you want to think about how often these encounters are happening. They don't necessarily have to be combat, but combat is the easiest to think about. But the more encounters you have in a session, the more you can just directly target the weaknesses of certain characters in the group. And it's probably better to like hit multiple at once, so the fight is, you know, there's some commiseration at the table of like, oh no, I'm the fire mage and I can't use my cool fire spells, and like, oh no, I'm the rogue and everything is in bright light.
Yeah, if you're targeting more than one character, this prevents you from getting into a situation where it's, you know, one person is not having fun for 2.5 hours.
Right.
And everyone else is having a great time and doesn't necessarily notice.
And then the flip side, if you're having fewer encounters in a session, then you want to target the weaknesses less often, because there's just less chance to use the abilities. Every player is going to want to take those chances to do their cool stuff.
Right. You need to make sure that the pendulum doesn't flip from interesting challenge to frustratingly impotent. You've got a character who's good at a thing. Okay, they can't do it this one time. That's fine. But if you only have one encounter in a 6-hour session, that means that entire session, that character didn't get to do their cool thing.
Right.
So, great. That's, what, a week, a month where they didn't get to do their cool thing.
The flip side is if you target the entire party at once in their weaknesses, so everybody is kind of fighting off their back foot, then it feels a little bit more fair. It feels like that was the challenge, right? This was the situation that we weren't ready for, and we had to figure it out as a team.
And in situations like this, you probably want to dial down the difficulty level of the encounter, because the difficulty is sort of built into the fact that your players aren't able to bring their strengths to bear.
So let's talk a little bit more about encounter building then.
The challenge here is that you are building the encounter essentially as a puzzle. Like, part of figuring out the encounter itself is for the PCs to figure out how it is they're going to overcome whatever obstacle is preventing them from using their abilities to the full.
And that can be frustrating for players, right? Like, that's where it feels like the world has conspired against them, and it feels like the GM is targeting them, not like an organic piece of the story has emerged.
But it can also be a little frustrating for GMs, because if you are trying to figure out like one thing that is going to stymie all of your party members, like one enemy, that's that's pretty complicated. And even if you're figuring out, you know, all different types of, you know, terrain or monsters, or obstacles that are going to make things more difficult for each of your players, it can be tough to put all of that into one encounter that sort of makes sense logically within the game fiction.
So that's why I prefer to just build my encounters organically, so that they fit the parameters of the setting and the story. So, like, this goes back to, like, even the OD&D books when they talk about dungeon ecology and, like, what things live in dungeons and why and how. Or you have certain, like, terrain-based, like, encounter tables, right? Like, it makes sense that there would be a brass dragon in the desert because that's their native, like, terrain.
Or is it bronze?
Who cares?
I can never remember. Nobody cares about metallic dragons. yeah, actually, you know, those dragons by terrain or monsters by terrain, those lists are very helpful. Like, let's say you've got a fighter who specializes in melee combat. Great. You've also got a pyromancer. You just look at the list and go, hey, red dragon works really well for both of those. Like, even if it's a young one or even a wyrmling, right? It flies and is immune to fire and breathes fire.
Mm-hmm.
Great. How is the melee fighter and the pyromancer going to handle this thing?
You know, likewise, outside of just picking monsters, if the players have decided that their characters are going to go after the Thieves Guild, well, the Thieves Guild probably has lots of clever defenses and traps and those types of things, so they can't really be upset when you throw a bunch of those at them.
Yeah, if you're assaulting the Wizard's Tower. It makes sense that this is an opportunity for the wizard to occasionally shine because they can recognize what's going on here. At the same time, the wizard who's defending his tower also knows the tricks that the party wizard can throw.
Right. And I think the key to doing this effectively is, like, signposting, right? Don't let this stuff be a surprise. Make it clear that, you know, you're making a trade-off as a party if you pursue this course. So if you're going to march through the night, it's going to be harder to keep watch from ambush predators.
Yeah, it's not a problem. It's not too much metagaming for you as the GM to actually say, hey, yeah, you're assaulting the Wizard's Tower, and that's going to be great for you, the wizard, because you're going to be able to know what's going on. At the same time, they know what you're capable of because they're also a wizard. Keep that in mind.
Yeah, or just straight up remind them, right? Like, you guys would probably want to do some research about, like, what's in that wizard tower and how has he secured it? Even Conan the Barbarian had a helpful hint and guide a couple times.
You know, and if they don't take that advice, pish posh, I don't do research, that's great. That's part of the story now, and then they can't complain, or maybe they're actually looking for the kind of challenge where they can't bring their strongest abilities to bear when they're there. Great. You now have free reign to target their weaknesses, because right, that's exactly what the NPC would do.
Exactly. And they're kind of, you know, signing up. They had the chance to figure out some other secondary ability that they could rely on, and if they didn't, it's their problem.
I'd say we also recommend doing this pretty much anytime you're building an encounter, but you want to build in such a way that you can make changes on the fly, that the encounter is flexible. Especially when you do want to focus on a particular weakness or stymie a particular strength of an individual character. Because, you know, maybe you misjudge the situation. There are definitely times when you've got someone who is more frustrated than you anticipated them to be, or maybe is in more dire straits than you thought they would be when confronting the challenge that you've placed.
Yeah, so if you structure your encounters in stages, then after they kind of get through the first stage and you can get the measure of how they performed, like, the second stage can kind of come in with a new set of challenges, and you can scale that to sort of who is outshining, who needs a chance to shine, right? Like, who do I need to share a little bit of spotlight with, all within kind of one encounter or challenge.
And then each of these stages you can scale up or down depending on how your players are doing. You can start targeting a character's weaknesses if they're outshining someone else who is really hampered by what's going on in the encounter currently. Some of the obstacles can also be temporary. You know, maybe there's a fire elemental, but there's just one at the beginning, and once someone actually takes that out, then the pyromancer becomes much more useful. Or there's a way to put out those fires.
Right. So that's a good summary of the dull mechanical aspects of this. Now we kind of come to the more philosophical question, Ishan, which is, when should characters feel like badasses?
Almost all the time, is what I think, personally. Like, feeling like your shtick isn't working should be rare enough that it's interesting. Rare enough that it's a fun challenge because you're not allowed to do the same thing that you typically rely on, because most of the time you feel extremely competent. And players can understand, or at least realize that, hey, you know, I'm doing something in a different fashion right now. Like, I don't have my thieves' tools because we got thrown in jail or whatever. You know, I've got to attempt to pick a lock with like a shard of metal that I found on the ground or something like that. Great. It shouldn't last that long. Players should be able to overcome this and then go back to doing the thing that they actually built or played their character to be good at.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of dependent on setting and tone, but I think in general, players are going to be turned off by games where the mechanics are difficult. So like a good example of this is Only War, which is the Warhammer 40K RPG, where you play guardsmen who are notoriously short-lived and not very well trained, and so your odds of doing anything successfully tend to be very low, like sub 50%, which, as it turns out, just means you don't get to do the thing that you wanted to do very often, which isn't so much reinforcing the tone of the game as much as it is just frustrating you as you try to move the story forward. And I think that's the important balance that you have to keep in mind, is that succeeding in most games at any task is sort of the chance for the players to direct the narrative. And if they're constantly failing, it tends to mean they're not getting that narrative control that they're playing an RPG for.
Yeah, it means they're not really participating. They're just sort of experiencing the depressing story that the GM is telling.
Right. I mean, if you want to play soldiers in a World War I trench, you can do that. I would just hope that your mechanics aren't based on, you know, surviving trench foot.
I've replaced all your D20s with D6s. Enjoy. I think, you know, there are certain kinds of games where it's fine to do this more than you would otherwise. Like an OSR game, right? You don't necessarily think, hey, you know, I'm a level zero farmer and we're going into this dungeon because my liege has ordered me to do it. And, you know, hopefully I come out there with like a few coppers and maybe a rusty dagger that I can sell and that before I go back in there. But, you know, you don't really have any abilities or powers or strengths that you're relying on anyway. You know, everything is going to be terrible for you. So it's kind of fine if it's targeting your weakness, which is, you know, having 1d4 hit points.
Yeah, anything. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the basis of the funnel in Dark Sun, or I guess it's called the funnel too in Dungeon Crawl Classics, right? But the idea of, like, you need to bring multiple characters because you are unlikely to live long enough to succeed multiple times, which is fine. Again, it's like sort of tone and setting dependent, but those games need to be, they signpost that and they get player buy-in in the premise before you start.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also fine for a GM to work with a player to sort of build out a narrative arc for a character who is, you know, very focused on maybe one trick, to expand their horizons within the fiction of the game. Like, if you take your traditional pyromancer, I think in fiction a lot of the times you get someone who like only uses fire, and that's fine, but in a game setting where there are creatures that are physically made of fire and there are a lot of creatures that are immune to fire because they breathe it or swim in it, it would make sense that that adventurer has other things that they can do, that picks other spells or learns an additional element, or, you know, takes up the sword and has a way to actually contribute to the party when fire doesn't work. And I think that's a potentially interesting thing for a character to be confronted with, and then they go, you know what, I maybe need to learn how to do something else also. It doesn't mean I have to stop being a pyromancer.
Right.
How about fire and lightning?
I mean, that was sort of the entire final arc of the Morning Glory campaign for me, right? Like, Brand was all about purifying flames as a Silver Flame Inquisitor, and it just turned out that we were fighting against demons and devils for the entire last arc. So you ended up having to give me an ability that let me get radiant damage just so that I could continue doing anything.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about it, and I was like, I mean, I guess you could pick totally different spells. It doesn't really make sense that this guy isn't fire, because he's literally the shadow in the flame.
Right.
So I'm not changing that. How about I just give you radiant?
Sold. It does seem to be kind of a weird world problem where inquisitors, who should have holy fire, have no way of dealing with demons, who are largely fire-based.
It's just because your build was terrible.
Yeah, that's sure. To come back to, like, the inverse of the question, right? When should you not feel like a badass as a player? I think it's, there are definitely arcs that you can run where you deliberately unsettle the players from their kind of usual comfort level. Prison escapes are, you know, an example that you've already mentioned, where you expect to not have all of your stuff and to be relying on sort of secondary and tertiary abilities to solve that puzzle of getting your stuff back and then feeling like a badass again. And I think that will also work for encounter types that are not core to your game, right? So a combat-heavy encounter in a very socially driven game will feel the same way. A social encounter in a Dungeon Crawl Classics game is going to feel very fish out of water as well.
Yeah, I think it's also a nice opportunity to remind your players, or, you know, remind the characters in game that they're in a party for a reason, that they rely on these other people. And, you know, this happens sometimes with the prison break when everyone's in a different cell or separated. It happens when you split the party. But, you know, they have to rely on only their own abilities. And you can see it when someone runs into the rogue again and is like, oh God, I'm so glad you're here. I had to talk and open locks. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. Just split the party and you can get them into their get them out of their core abilities pretty quickly. That's the secret I keep in my back pocket, because we have a group of 8 PCs.
Also, we're idiots. And we're like, I don't know, maybe we should go in different directions. What do you think?
Every time I suggest it, you guys do it.
That's just because we're trying to lose some of them.
That's true. I do think it's also important to strike a balance between, like, the threat of impending doom and the triumph of the players, like, clever, good ideas. Which is to say, like, if you're going to target a player, it does make more sense to target their weaknesses than it does to target their strength. Because if you just if you bully through somebody's strength and like, they've put up their shield wall and you've just smashed right through it, like, it makes them feel like there's no hope, right? Like, the one cool thing that we did wasn't enough. We're just overmatched, right? So what can we do?
Yeah, run away, I guess.
Exactly. Whereas if you're hitting their weakness, they go, okay, we knew we're weak to this. We have to pivot, right? Like, we have to do something slightly different because they're targeting it, but we're still fundamentally doing our stuff. So, like, we still have some hope.
Yeah, and it's fine to target the PCs in a way that makes sense within the game and then allows them to feel powerful. Like, if you have an enemy that hits hard, it's okay if they take their first swings at the, like, heavily armored paladin with the shield and Shield of Faith up. You know, or the robot who has, like, you know, 11 inches of, like, adamantine plate on. Mm-hmm. Like, it's fine. That person doesn't get hurt, or maybe they don't get hit. And after, like, a few punches that were completely ineffective, then the enemy will probably think, maybe I should disengage and go attack someone who's wearing robes. It didn't completely stymie the encounter, but it did let the player feel like they were accomplishing something. And now, of course, you're still targeting the weakness of the person who doesn't wear any armor.
Well, that's important. You said it doesn't stymie the encounter. It could if you don't plan for that in your encounter build, right? So, like, know that you're going to throw away a round, throwing a bone to the paladin so he can feel like an armored fortress before some of your enemies are going to go geek the mage. Right, like, plan for that sort of stuff so that you can let one player feel great before moving on to making the challenge appropriate.
Yeah, it'll buy you a bit of currency when targeting the weaknesses.
Right.
I also think for players and GMs, it's important to remember that like being good at something is not necessarily the most fun part of playing an RPG. Really, it's spotlight. And like being the focus of the story for a little bit of time. And you get that whether you are succeeding very well or failing miserably and need to figure out a way not to be failing. Like, it's kind of nice story-wise if you can't use your main abilities, because now you have an opportunity to role play how you're going to figure out getting out of that situation. So use that opportunity. You know, you could sulk for an hour and a half of combat where you know, your weapon attacks don't really work, or you could look up the grapple rules.
Yeah. What is the help action exactly?
And what does that look like in game? Like, how does my big burly fighter help you aim an arrow? Because, you know, for some reason I didn't bring a bow.
You got a William Tell him.
You hold your fingers like a V.
So I think the feeling you want to leave the players with after an encounter that goes poorly, right? Or that it's more challenging than they thought or whatever.
Poorly within the game.
Like, right, yeah. Right. You want to leave them with a thought that there was something that they could have done differently, right? If they had planned better or researched better or predicted better or even just rolled better, right? Whatever it is, like there was something in their control that would have made that encounter go differently. The whole element of targeting the players only really feels that way when the players feel like the GM had it in for them, and that usually comes because they don't see any alternative to what they had done to receive that outcome.
Yeah, and make sure that if looking back your players are like, oh boy, let's make sure that never happens again, and they do take steps to mitigate whatever obstacle you threw at them,
you got
to
throw that again, buddy.
Yeah, and then have it not work. Like, have them succeed, get around it,
right?
You know, that's the reward for them, like actually trying to problem solve. Don't then throw the same thing at them and then haha, this time it's different again, go screw.
No, yeah, raise the stakes and throw the same encounter. Let them get the final win. All right, do you hear that, Ishan?
That's me really hoping that arrow hit the apple.
Bad news, buddy.
I didn't look. I said it was a trick shot.
It didn't, and it's time to go to the character creation forge, roll up a new character. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, at Evil Sends Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show, at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com. Finally.
TotalPartyThrillCast.com still works too.
Yeah, the old one still works.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
All right. This week in the Character Creation Forge, we are building the homing missile.
This is some sort of flying bunker buster build?
Well, I guess it could be. We haven't ruled that out.
You can do it exactly once.
Right.
Okay, so what is the homing missile?
So the homing missile is an expert tracker who doesn't miss with that big shot.
Always hits.
Always hits once.
I've talked about this before. I really like builds that don't miss because more than anything, I hate missing. Mm-hmm. I would rather do a relatively small amount of damage consistently than have like a swingy I missed, big hit.
Yeah, because like you gotta wait through all these turns in combat and it's finally your chance and you like roll one lousy d20 and it's like, nope, okay, your turn, next.
Yeah, if you had one chance.
Yeah, one opportunity. It's mom's spaghetti.
What is the build?
Ranger 2, War Cleric 2, Sorcerer 16.
I like this spread of levels because it is unusual.
Yeah, it also doesn't get you ninth level spells.
Nah.
Well, it doesn't get you ninth level spells known. It does get you the slots.
Yeah, it gets you to 8, and then the sorcerer goes, wish, whatever.
Yeah, mass polymorph.
Blah, blah. But it does give you some pretty amazing spells to play in the first 19 levels of the game.
Yeah, so your basic function here, taking a couple spells that kind of give you some tracking ability. So first is Hunter's Mark from Ranger, which gives you advantage on your wisdom survival and wisdom perception to find the target of your Hunter's Mark.
It's also your damage bread and butter.
Well, right, yeah, it just adds some damage as well. But then more importantly, Mind Spike, which is a level 2 spell from Xanathar's Guide, and that just lets you know where the target is if you hit them with the spell.
Yeah, I've always loved this one. Like, it's a divination spell. It does psychic damage. You hit them in the brain and then leave a little something there.
Right. So once you know where they are, the other like quality of the homing missile is that you don't miss. So you're going to take a spell that has a attack roll and then use your War Cleric Channel Divinity to give yourself a plus 10 on that attack roll and pretty much guarantee that you're going to land that big spell.
Yeah, because the Channel Divinity is only if needed. You don't have to do it ahead of time.
Right.
So what are some spells that you would use?
Well, the bread and butter for this is going to be Chromatic Orb, because it lets you choose your damage type, which means you've got different warheads in your missile, for example.
Wait, including poison damage? It's a chemical weapon, my friend.
Well, you can get thunder and lightning.
Very, very frightening.
That will scale up to a 9th level spell at 10d8 damage, which is that's a good fistful of dice there. You're probably going to be borrowing all the d8s at the table, actually, to try and roll that. But you'll also have Magic Missile for your kind of more rudimentary, can't-miss activities. And then my personal favorite, and kind of the reason that I like this as the homing missile, Plane Shift.
Which sends them home.
Sends them home.
I see.
Yeah, so Plane Shift is a touch. You make a touch attack, attack roll to hit an unwilling creature, and then they make a saving throw. So it is kind of like 2 points of failure, which is generally not how you want to do these things. But that's okay. It's a cool thing to do. You can send them to any plane that you would like, to a random place. The plane of elemental fire, or elemental water, or elemental lightning. I don't care. Just a place where that person is going to be in pain.
Yeah, speaking of targeting their weaknesses, I'm a pyromancer and I'm facing a fire. I plane shift you to the elemental plane of water.
Right.
Enjoy.
Yeah, doused.
Oh, you're a human. I plane shift you to literally any elemental plane.
Right. Then, of course, banish is sort of the lower level version of this. Unless they have a home plane, they'll just be sent to an extra dimensional space. So not quite the finisher that Plane Shift is, but a little more economical since it's only a 4th level spell.
You're also getting the other goodies from your classes. You know, so Ranger gets you Favored Enemy. Natural Explorer, of course, helps you with low level tracking, which you're going to want to be able to do before you get some of these higher level spells. You also get spells like Long Strider, which lets you keep up with some of your longer-legged or faster-moving quarry.
Yeah, you only get 2 Ranger spells. You're probably going to spend one of them on Hunter's Mark. You only get 1 other choice. I would still choose Long Strider because I always feel like the missile has to be faster than the target. So go ahead and give yourself that little boost.
You also get level 1 Cleric spells, which is like great.
That's a pretty big list of spells. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you're also going to get guidance, right, as a cantrip, which of course is going to make all of your perception or investigation or like tracking survival skill checks even better.
And then to reinforce the whole missile aspect here of the homing missile, you'll get your meta magic and spell points as a sorcerer. And typically, empowered spell is going to be your bread and butter that lets you reroll damage for a spell after you've rolled the damage, so you can just pick whichever dice you'd like and re-roll those. But there's also some other useful abilities.
I mean, yeah, you never sneeze at Quicken.
Yeah, Quicken and Twin yeah. are great. And then also Heighten spell will impose disadvantage on a saving throw.
Plane shift.
Yeah, exactly. So that's going to be, you know, just throw in 3 points for your plane shift.
As for leveling order, I think it probably makes the most sense to start as Ranger, just get those two levels out of the way, and then maybe go Sorcerer 5 to get third level spells. You can knock out your Cleric and then finish off Sorcerer.
So, Ishin, who is your homing missile?
My homing missile is traumatized by the time she missed that shot.
That counted. William Tell. But like the darkest timeline.
Have we already done Sharon Stone from Quick and the Dead?
I don't think so. let me just quickly look through the... No, not Sharon Stone from Quick and the Dead. No.
Where like the guys have strung up her father to hang him, and they give her a gun and say, if you can shoot the rope, then he's free to go. But of course, you know, she's a terrible shot and instead shoots him in the chest. She's like 6 years old.
Spoilers.
It's, yeah. Also, I think it's not a great movie. And it's like a 20-year-old movie. Get over it.
Well, hang on. Okay. The Quick and the Dead was fine. Was it? The Quick and the Dead is in that, like, I don't actually
look, it's
remember.
No Maverick.
Okay. God.
It's no Unforgiven. How about that?
Okay.
It's no Tombstone. We good? We good? Should I keep going?
Yeah, Tombstone isn't even in like the canon of great cowboy movies. But I love it so much.
But yeah, I think it's more like a William Tell scenario, actually, where she was foolhardy and took a dare. Thought she could definitely pull this off. And in fact, put a bunch of money on this. And her best friend had full faith in her and was like, yeah, you're going to hit this apple.
Oh, so it's Snatch.
No problem.
I get it.
Wait, I don't remember that scene. I just remember, you like dicks?
Wasn't the whole scheme that they were betting on a boxer who's going to take a dive?
Oh, I see.
Or was that Lockstock? I can't remember.
They're the same.
Anyway.
I seem to recall, did he punch an apple off someone's head, but then he hit him in the throat instead?
We probably punched an Adam's apple off somebody's head.
Hey, look at that. Yeah, but she misses. She misses and swears she's never going to miss again when it actually counts. And she said, oh, maybe I'll be clutch, but decided on this build instead.
Okay.
And, of course, the tracking ability is useful to find the people who goaded her into that unwise bargain in the first place. Going to track them down and make them pay.
Okay.
Shane, what about your homing missile?
My homing missile is an enforcer. Probably a shady organization, right? Not necessarily a great person, but you know, when somebody owes the Thieves Guild money, they've got to get a tracker on the job who can make sure that person doesn't ever owe them money again.
It's a bail bondsman.
Bail bondsman is, I suppose, the only slightly less exploitative way. but the idea here is that this is the person that you call when you need somebody found, and especially if you need somebody found and then hurt. So that's what my homing missile does. Works for the local Thieves Guild, gets set on the trail, picks up the scent of whoever the target is, and follows them to wherever we need to go to settle up. And this kind of makes sense for a party, right? Because who knows what the party was hired for in the first place to bring them together, and this is a particularly useful set of skills.
I mean, I'm just picturing Dog the Bounty Hunter right now.
Yeah. Yep.
But in robes, arcane robes. Same haircut.
Doesn't have to be in robes. We got medium armor as a cleric. Heavy armor as a war cleric.
Oh, yeah, okay. In full plate with pauldrons, right. Big epaulets.
Which is very Dog the Bounty Hunter. That's exactly what he would wear if he could wear armor.
Same hair,
yeah. All right, before we wrap up, we want to take a moment to thank our Patreon supporters.
Yeah, your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill. I like to call them Total Party Frills.
Oh, okay.
Hmm?
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, we really should have marketed that sooner.
Someday, we'll get there.
It's never too late.
You can also leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And if you do, we'll read it on the air. This is How Are There Not More Reviews of TPT by UberGeek.
A very good question, UberGeek.
Are we almost? We're almost at 100.
Yeah, we're at 96.
Ooh,
who's going to be that lucky 100th review?
because they'll get some stuff, I guess.
Sure. Yeah.
Why not?
Why not?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Perfect. Done. We've just launched a contest.
This is a well-done, classy gaming podcast. The hosts provide some great insight into a wide range of topics that really help add flavor to any campaign, or even one-shots. As a bonus, the episodes are family-friendly, so no sudden F-bombs. Or at least they're bleeped out. Listening to them retell the story of the homebrew campaign they ran has given me some ideas I'm hoping to incorporate into my own. Definitely binge listening worthy, which is what I'm doing now, so I can still look forward to a lot of episodes. Oh, yes, yes you can, plus every single week. Oh my god, I can't believe we do this every week.
Yeah, once a week. Every week for 3 years.
Even Thanksgivings. Mm-hmm. Especially Thanksgiving.
Especially Thanksgiving.
Because
yeah.
Sometimes you don't necessarily want to.
Let's start pretend the holidays are a hardship. They're a blessing.
Sure. Yeah. You go with that.
All right.
Look, not if you're the homing missile because your family's dead because of one terrible mistake you made.
But that's the you can never go homing missile.
Hey.
All right. What do we have planned for next week's episode?
We've got a full cover-to-cover review of the 5th edition of Vampire the Masquerade.
And since it's publishing at 6 a.m. Eastern, that could very well be the very first review ever released for Vampire 5th.
Oh, my God. It is the day of the embargo. Dun, dun, dun.
All right. That's it for episode 155 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name. But either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.